Our final case this morning is United States against Scott. Mr. Anderson.
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Kent Anderson with the Federal Public Defender's Office of the Central District of Illinois, representing the appellant Todd Scott. In this case, Mr. Scott was convicted of conspiracy to commit mail fraud, wire fraud, and structuring currency transactions in order to avoid cash transaction reporting requirements. At sentencing, the district court imposed the unusual condition of prohibiting Mr. Scott from accessing the internet without the probation officer's permission. That condition didn't have anything to do with the offense of conviction. Instead, it was related to an allegation that Mr. Scott had possessed 5 pictures of child pornography, which he had downloaded from a Usenet news group on the internet. And there wasn't any advance notice that the court might impose such a condition. Instead, the government first raised this issue during the sentencing hearing, when it asked the court to prohibit Mr. Scott from using a computer.
Do you have any alternatives that you think would be better? That is, what in your view would be an appropriate way of dealing with somebody whose background includes child pornography offenses, even if he hasn't been convicted of them?
Well, certainly the court could have made it explicit condition that he not access any sites which had pictures of
just take his
children.
Word for it?
No. I was going to elaborate on that. There would no doubt have to be enforcement conditions. Either condition would require unannounced visits by the probation officer. The court could also require that Mr. Scott allow the probation officer to access any computer files that Mr. Scott had and give the officer any user identities and passwords that he uses for any purpose. In addition, the court could prohibit access to news groups not approved by the probation officer, since that's where Mr. Scott was alleged to have got these pictures, and that's only a very small part of the internet. Court could also require that Mr. Scott not use any encryption software without giving the probation officer the password.
Okay.
And I'm sorry.
Well, one reason why I asked this question was just to find out whether, with the benefit of hindsight, you now had some options that you might offer to the district judge that you were unable to offer on the fly. And it seems to me that the answer is yes, you did have some options that now, with a little research, you could offer.
Yes, actually, I was not trial counsel, but certainly, I was able to come up with these options with the benefit of a little more time that trial counsel did not have on fly, and he ended up using a shotgun-type approach due to his surprise and didn't know what to focus on, even mentioned using computers in cars, watches, anything else he could think of.
In the event he presents these options to the probation officer, who is going to make the determination at this point, and the probation officer says, no way, you can't touch the internet, period, would there be some way he could move to have that sentence adjusted?
Probably. I believe there are options for
supervised release.
Modification of conditions, although, of course, that's much more difficult once the conditions have been imposed to try to get the court to do that, especially without the probation officer support.
Well, obviously, it would be saying the probation officer is unreasonable. And for instance, say he's got to have a job where you have to do orders through the internet or something, and he said, I'd be willing to have the confines of the restrictions my employer puts on using the internet, which is fairly strict, but I have to be able to do this in order to do the job. And the probation officer says, no way.
That's
a hypothetical, obviously. I would hope that wouldn't occur.
Yes, we would like to hope that wouldn't happen, but it is a possibility, and that may be why the Tenth Circuit expressed concern in Walzer, in which the court did find it wasn't plain error, but that found that it might very well have been error, a similar condition, because the vagueness of the condition might allow the probation officer to unreasonably restrict the central means of information gathering and communication.
Have the district judges in this district imposed internet conditions before?
To be honest, I don't know. I think they may have in cases that actually involved conviction on child pornography cases, although I'm not sure about that. I certainly have not heard of any where the offense of conviction was not a child pornography case.
Yeah. Well, I'm not so much interested in that as in another way of exploring the theme that my colleague opened up, which is to figure out what the probation officer does with these conditions. Now, if there haven't been, if these conditions are very unusual, we wouldn't know.
No.
One could readily see trouble if the probation officer basically tries to block people from reading the New York Times online.
And that is certainly a concern which led the Second Circuit to reverse similar conditions.
But they're just captives of the New York Times.
Well, they didn't specifically mention the New York Times, but it was a concern of the use of email for communication and any newspaper, weather forecast, research, anything else that would be lawful, regardless of their feelings about the New York Times. But in answer to your question, the fact is, I don't know. I only know what has come up on appeal, and this issue hasn't been on appeal in this circuit. And, of course, these issues could have been explored below had there been advance notice, which is why Rule 32 requires the notice, and in this circuit that includes conditions of supervised release under United States v. Engel. And this court has found that initial notice at the sentencing hearing just doesn't comply with Rule 32. In fact, Judge Coffey has stated that defense counsel cannot be faulted for failing to anticipate or be prepared to argue every conceivable ground on which a trial judge might choose to enhance a defendant's sentence. And in the same case of United States v. Jackson, Judge Posner stated such an expectation might be unrealistic given the too frequent inadequacy of criminal defense lawyers.
Well, what is an enhancement of supervised release? I mean, we talk about, what is it, a special condition in some extreme cases, like having to register for the sex offender. Is it the same as the standard of doing something, adding to a sentence under sentencing guidelines as opposed to supervised release conditions?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of your question.
Is there a difference between sentencing and supervised release conditions?
As far as Rule 32, no, there is not, with the possible exception of those conditions that are actually set forth in the guidelines, certainly standard conditions. The defendant has notice of those, and any others that are mentioned in the pre-sentence report, they would have notice, but it would be similar to an adjustment.
So it doesn't matter how severe it is? Just anything that doesn't get notice is...
Well, certainly, it might matter for prejudice purposes, but not for the purpose of it actually being error. And with that, I'll think I'm into my rebuttal time, so probably should sit down. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Smith.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I dispute the law a bit with my colleague, first as to whether advance notice, pre-sentencing notice, is required any time a district court seeks to impose a special condition of supervised release. Apart from the sex registration requirement...
Don't you think there will be a more informed exchange if some notice is given of unusual conditions? This case may illustrate the point. At the time of sentencing, the defendant's lawyer may have had no idea what the other options were for limiting access to child pornography other than just a blanket ban. And that's something that with any amount of notice might have been discussed in a useful way before the district judge.
I think you're right, Your Honor, that some notice for any condition of supervised release might be helpful, but it's not legally required under the law. And for instance, in this particular case, there was not an absolute ban on the use of the Internet. It actually required that...
Yes, in many ways it's worse. It requires the defendant to submit to some petty bureaucrat and accept whatever the bureaucrat says. Now, usually we think of putting a bureaucrat between somebody and the means of communication, whether it's email or reading the Times, as about the worst conceivable thing under the First Amendment. Right? One can imagine clear rules like don't download child porn, but appointing some government agent who's going to say what you can read and when you can send email, would one think, be pretty much what the First Amendment is aimed at.
Well, respectfully, one, the First Amendment's not involved in this. And secondly, let me make a couple of points. One is,
stay close to the podium.
I'm sorry. I don't think that there's been any case that says someone has a right to use the Internet while they're imprisoned. And this
That's clear.
Okay.
So I'm I gather that the 20-month sentence was the maximum sentence under the guidelines. You would be in a very good position if, say, the maximum guideline sentence were 3 years. The defendant was given 2 years plus 1 year's restricted Internet access, because you obviously couldn't get the Internet while you were in prison. But that doesn't appear to be the situation here.
This was not the maximum
sentence. There was no trade-off between time in prison and lack of Internet access.
In fact, all a defendant had to do, Todd Scott had to do, the appellant in this case, is to try and get reasonable accommodations worked out with the supervised release officer. And if it couldn't be agreed to, it's not just the arbitrary decision of the bureaucrat, Your Honor. He can come back into court and essentially appeal or contest whatever rulings or decisions that supervised release officer has made. It's not a total ban. It was never meant to be a total ban.
That's what it says. It says a total ban, except to the extent some governmental censor allows you to have access. Now, in place of the word some governmental censor, the district court used probation officers.
Without prior approval, Your Honor.
Exactly. Well, prior approval to use means of communication, getting the approval of a government censor, is something that ought to be troubling to you. It's troubling to me.
Well, I view prior approval, Your Honor, as being able to do some sort of accommodations, like working out a filtering device on his computers that he's using that he can't get in and manipulate or tamper with. That is an accommodation. Prior approval can mean things, Your Honor, like maintaining a history of your Internet usage and agreeing not to delete it. The accommodations were supposed to be made with the supervised release officer. And respectfully, there is no case out there that goes to the extent that appellant is trying to take this court. The Second Circuit case of Sofsky is, other courts have said, is out there on left field, but that banned the use of a computer and the Internet, not just simply the use of the Internet. There are many other cases out there which have upheld what we're seeking in this particular case. Crandon, U.S. v. Crandon, a Third Circuit case, is a good illustration. U.S. v. Paul, a Fifth Circuit case, is a good illustration. A more recent case of United States v. Deaton, a district court case from Arkansas from 2002, prohibited the use of services on the Internet or subscribing to Internet providers without permission, without prior approval of the U.S. Probation Office. That was upheld. So if there are any questions, I'll be glad to answer. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Anything further, Mr. Anderson?
Yes, so just reiterate that this court has applied in United States v. Engle the Rule 32 to special conditions of supervised release, especially at least those that are not specifically mentioned in the guidelines. And as Judge Eastbrook pointed out, the condition does implicate the First Amendment. And the Second Circuit case of Sofsky, true, the condition was broader, but the court's discussion focused on the use of the Internet. The cases the government mentioned of Crannon and Paul, the holdings support the government's position. However, while the courts found that the conditions were narrowly tailored, one was a complete prohibition, one was similar to this, they didn't say why, so there's no reasoning which any other court can rely upon. Therefore, this court should not find them to be persuasive, and as I've explained, a more narrow restriction certainly is possible. Thus, we'd ask this court to remand for a sentencing hearing in compliance with Rule 32, or in the alternative, if finds that Rule 32 was complied with to reverse the condition because it was greater than reasonably necessary to achieve the purposes of sentencing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, Counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until next week.